Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a Lip Media podcast.
You're listening to Queers, a podcast about politics and culture with Simon Copland and Benjamin Riley. It's the 8th of July 2019, I'm Benjamin Riley, and welcome to Queers. Each episode we talk our way through questions on a theme, and today we have an interview with writer and researcher Jaya Keeney. Jaya writes for a number of online publications and teaches queer theory at the University of Sydney, and her work examines kinship, queers of colour, critical studies of science, and reproductive justice. Earlier this year, Jaya completed her PhD, which studied concepts of race in the stories of queer families who conceive kids using reproductive technologies. And this is the work I wanted to talk to her about after meeting Jaya through my own research. We've spoken about queer families occasionally on Queers, but with a topic where the stakes can feel so high, I wanted to talk to an expert who thinks critically about some of the most challenging issues facing our communities. Enjoy the interview. So, elevator pitch for your...
Elevator pitch.
Your PhD.
So my PhD was about the experiences of queer families in Australia that have kids via reproductive technologies, and specifically surrogacy and donor conception. And I focused on their experiences of race and their concepts of race. And did a number of interviews with them. But the sort of question at the heart of the research was... if race and reproduction are really closely entwined, like we presume that race comes from your parents who had heterosexual sex to conceive you, and that's the way that your kind of bodily race and your identity both flow, what happens when queer people have kids in a different way? Does that mean they relate to race differently? What can they tell us about race when it's detached from biological connection, but it's still an important part of the family?
And what did you find? And obviously that's a small question, which I'm sure with a million answers, but I guess particularly, did you find that participants wanted to replicate that biological relationship between race and identity?
I found a lot of things, and a bit of yes and no to your question. I found that even when parents decided to race match, which is what it's often called in clinical practice and also the critical scholarship, which is when a couple, it's presumed typically to be a couple, picks a donor that matches physically and racially the non-biological parent. They'll pick to match to replicate that traditional family. I found that my participants had really quite nuanced ways of articulating the importance of that, that weren't just about this kind of visible matching kind of thing, which is presumed why people do it. I think because the clinical practice presumes straight couples. And in particular, a lot of my participants talked about how passing wasn't possible for them. And so it was more about sort of social reinforcement in terms of selling to the world that they're a family in the context of the oppression they were very aware they were going to face.
What do you mean by passing?
As in passing as if they'd conceived without assistance.
Oh, okay. Was that because they might have been same-sex couples, for example?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So they felt that it was going to be very evident already that they hadn't conceived without assistance.
Okay.
And so they felt that they kind of had this opportunity to reinvent the family form,
which
didn't necessarily mean through picking a donor of a different race, but just meant that they kind of had more nuanced articulations of race than just saying that it's a physical match that makes a family.
What kinds of considerations went into even thinking about, it feels funny to say, like, you know, picking a race for their child or for the surrogate or whoever was involved?
Well, I mean, the race of the, choosing the race of the donor and the race of the surrogate varied really widely. So I was really interested in the fact that choosing a surrogate is not often treated as a racializing decision, because we presume that race comes from the sperm and eggs, not from the womb. And typically in surrogacy arrangements, you use separate eggs and a surrogate. So when people were picking a surrogate, they typically talked about either a pre-existing relationship or cost effectiveness. Obviously, in a transnational market that's stratified by racial difference, cost is a racializing thing. But when picking a donor, I was surprised by the kind of diversity of motivations. So a lot of people, I mean, a lot of my participants chose people they already knew as their donors, and typically they chose people that they felt they had chemistry with. But then a lot of other people chose, for example, in order to access a new culture and bring a new culture into their lives, through picking cross-racially. And that was the other thing I really was interested in among my participants, is that most of the literature says that people race match, but overwhelmingly my participants, like about half of them, picked a donor that was not the same race as either them or their partner.
What do you mean by bringing a new culture into their lives?
So some, that kind of was in the minority, but some participants said that it was an opportunity, if they had to make a selection, to pick someone of a different race to introduce diversity into their lives. Oh. For example, so one, I mean, and this, obviously the implications of that vary depending on your own racial identity.
Sure.
But one couple I interviewed, is a lesbian couple. The mother who carried and used her eggs was white, and the other mother is Lebanese. And they chose a donor online, actually, who is Taiwanese. And the Lebanese mother, the non-biological mother, said that she really liked the idea of using a Taiwanese donor because the racial diversity of their family would reflect the queer diversity that was already present.
Oh, that's actually really lovely.
Yeah. So this kind of creative engagement with race that's still attuned to the different power structures at play. Yeah, that's lost in the idea of just wanting to match because that's what a family looks like, you know?
You know, that's one example, I guess. I mean, can you think of some other kind of narratives that emerged in terms of why people might have... I feel that it's funny. I feel the language around this just feels so loaded, you know?
Yeah.
Might have race matched or not.
Yeah. You know, I guess some of the narratives that I found more concerning that emerged were among largely white parents that chose donors of a non-white race, either because they felt it didn't matter or because they felt that they, this kind of idea, they'd be introduced to a new culture. So one of the women I interviewed was a white lesbian. She had a white partner, and they really, really wanted a black donor, preferably, or a donor of color, because they felt they didn't have any culture themselves.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and a black donor would bring culture into their lives through the child. And I don't, I mean, I'm not interested in condemning any of their decisions,
sure.
But more what interests me is like the total vacuum of conversation around what it looks like to actually raise kids of color with an awareness of racism and a kind of empowered racial identity. And I think that in the queer community, particularly, that absence is concerning, because if we're going to build sort of reproductive justice movements or think critically about how we could revolutionize parenting, we need to bring race into the conversation. Really centrally as well, not as an afterthought. And also racial difference isn't adequately captured just in the response of having queer pride about our families, even though it's a good first step.
Hmm. I mean, did you talk to parents who perhaps further down the line had to grapple with the implications of, say, like raising a kid that might have to deal with racism that they had never had to deal with?
Look, I guess the explosion in queer family creation through these kinds of technologies is relatively recent.
How recent would you say?
I think that there's been a real spike in the last 10 years. I interviewed one guy who said that his child, who was 10 at the time I interviewed him, I think 2 years ago, was one of the very first Australian kids born through surrogacy overseas, or formalised surrogacy.
Due to a law change, or just availability, or...?
Due to, I think, the availability of transnational markets, sure, which has really spiked, in particular in the last 5 years, mm-hmm, but, yeah, started to be more available in the last 10. So anyway, that was the oldest child whose parents I interviewed. But I did talk to some that had kids that maybe about 4 and 5 that were starting to talk about their racial identities. And I noticed that the main way it's dealt with is to minimise the impact of racial difference, which I think is part of a broader kind of colourblind multiculturalism in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and also sort of a lack of awareness about how kids might talk about race, which might not be in a clear language of sort of problems or struggles, but might just be, why am I different?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, we clearly just don't talk about a lot of this stuff in queer communities, right? Can you imagine what more open conversations around, I guess, the ethical dimensions of creating families through assisted reproductive technology might look like? Is there a way to do that that's not going to immediately be explosive and confronting?
Definitely. I mean, I think definitely. And I think a lot of queer families are already doing it and have been chipping away at this for a very long time. I think that race often gets left out of those conversations. But, like, for example, every family that I interviewed had reflected on and discussed and planned how they were going to talk to their child about their donor-conceived origins. And some of them had incredibly well-elaborated plans for how to start talking to their kids about how they were donor-conceived in this really positive way from birth. Some of them had made these, like, beautiful picture books of the kid's whole kind of conception journey and the surrogate, and really included those memories. So I think queers have a long history of doing that really well, and of kind of open communication and honesty around different forms of family creation not being an absence or a lack. And I think those kinds of resources and community skills could be used to talk about race as well. If we see race as part of the fabric of what creating a family always means for everyone, even white people, then building race into that in terms of, you know, really thinking critically about, if your surrogate comes from India, but you have a white child, maybe you need to talk to them about Indian cultural connection, or maybe not, but just opening that conversation about what a kind of broader concept of racial identity, a queered concept of racial identity might look like, rather than a sort of nuclear model of just, like, if your kid is conceived using white sperm and a white egg, that cuts out every other person that might be involved.
Why do you think race in particular is such a taboo, or is missing from these sorts of discussions?
I think that, well, a few things. I think that the conversation around race and racism in Australia is pretty abysmal, although it's changing at a glacial pace. And our sort of, like, predominant cultural response is either silence or turning bad feelings into good feelings by saying that really we're a colorblind society, or we don't notice race, or there's not really a big impact that race creates, especially if it's brought into the sort of loving space of the family, you know, to that. And then also I think the queer movement tends to be white dominated, and it's difficult to have intersectional conversations when you feel like you're sort of on the back foot or constantly campaigning for basic rights, and queer families in Australia continue to be really, really vulnerable. And not legally protected. But I guess if we don't take intersectional approaches as the centre, like the platform for every kind of campaign, then it's very hard to braid them in afterwards.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is a space where I can imagine that it, as you've already alluded to, where queers potentially have to confront, I guess, potential conflicts within our own conceptions of family and conceptions of ourselves and our communities in a way that's maybe in conflict with the very, like, you know, the queer family as this kind of pinnacle of wholesome,
right.
Respectable version of being queer.
Yeah.
Did those sorts of issues come out in the interviews at all in terms of people being kind of confronted by the possibility that they had had to grapple with ethically challenging decisions or not made ones that they potentially felt completely comfortable with?
I think, like, there was an investment across a lot of interviews, and there's a very heavily felt responsibility that a lot of queer parents carry around about performing good stories of their lives and their parenting responsibilities to paint their communities in a good and their families in a good light and for their children, and also because of the really real fear of persecution if they, you know, admit fault. So that's a difficult line to walk. But also there was some really powerful reflection in terms of how even, like, legal constraints in Australia being an altruistic-only jurisdiction mean that there's not many options for surrogacy. And so a lot of gay fathers in particular find themselves going overseas to access surrogacy services with surrogates they won't be able to build a relationship with in the future. And so some of their sort of parenting, like the ability to do family differently, is quite constrained by those legal frameworks too.
I guess I'm interested in the kind of intense drive to family at all that leads people to potentially very expensive or very involved or complicated reproductive processes.
Right.
How did those sorts of things come out in terms of people talking about their... I'm trying really hard not to use the word entitlement because I feel like it's like, you know, immediately puts things in a negative context. But I guess I'm interested in the how people framed their own desires or drive or needs to have families and have those families look particular ways.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think obviously it's a very privileged group of people that can access the fertility industry in Australia, particularly as any kind of public funding is being squeezed out of the market. A lot of my participants conceived with friends and family, and so that kind of lowers the cost. But I am really interested in how the fertility industry, I mean, you know, it's a global juggernaut. It's expected to be a $30 billion industry by 2023. A number of fertility companies have recently been floated on the stock exchange. So I think a lot of people I spoke with feel as if this narrative or this promise of choice that the industry sells to patients and also increasingly to queer people as a key target niche in the market is not really their reality at all. A lot of them felt that they didn't really have much choice at all. And they had to participate in the narrative of choice, but in these really constrained terms.
So what do you mean they felt they didn't have any choice at all? They didn't have any choice at all to do
as in, I mean, once they decided to make a family in this route. I think that the kind of cultural impact of the fertility industry also is crowding out space for us to imagine other family-making possibilities, or they don't get much airtime, even if they might be part of, you know, part of people's practices as well. Like, it's not an either or. I think that a lot of my participants have kids that are partly biologically related to them, and they also cultivate really powerful queer family networks that are not about biological or parenting ties. But those things become harder and harder to place at the center. Yeah. And, you know, I'm interested as well in how the latest frontier for a lot of fertility clinics is trans reproduction. And the implications that might have in creating a lot of options for trans people to do fertility preservation before they transition with hormones if they want to do that, but also how it might create these sort of compulsory pronatal pressures.
Mm. I mean, can you give us any insight into what the... I guess I'd be fascinated to hear about it in relation to marketing to trans people, but even just to... same-sex couples, like what sorts of narratives are fertility companies pushing.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're pushing an image of a happy, completed queer family, just like every other family, you know what I mean? And I think this has to do with the sort of corporate sponsorship and corporatisation of queer movements across the board as well. Like IVF Australia and Monash IVF have been key funders of the Mardi Gras in the past few years. There was a recently opened branch of City Fertility Clinic, which is a long-established multi-state fertility clinic that's specifically for rainbow families. It's called Rainbow Fertility. Yeah, and the narratives are sort of beautiful, glowing, white, same-sex, cis couples with a child, usually white or maybe like a nice mocha tone, but that's the picture that is sold. Yeah, and queerness becomes a very reduced thing in those representations.
Do you think we should be pushing back harder, or at least being more vocally critical of the influence of these companies in our communities?
I think that we should subject them to some kind of critical scrutiny in terms of the fact that they sell a promise of the best way to make a family, but there are other ways to do it. While not wanting to sort of, I think they've created huge opportunities for queer people. But, you know, for example, I think that there should be more publicly funded IVF clinics that are easier to access. I think that would be a kind of middle ground that means that this sort of biological focused reproduction is not the primary thing for queer people.
So could you draw a link for me? Why would the publicly funded clinics open up opportunities in that way?
Just because they'd create, like, they'd sort of broaden the pool out from people that can just afford to have, you know, multi-thousands of dollars of cycles of IVF.
Sure. So just make it more accessible. So while we were chatting about doing this interview, I came across an article that I shared with you and would be curious to get your thoughts about a couple in the US who use a gay couple who used one of their mothers was the surrogate and the other one's sister was the egg donor,
yeah.
I believe this was right.
Yeah.
And I guess it just really kind of struck me, you know, that I would be speaking to you about assisted reproductive technologies, but I guess the kind of, from the outside, very bizarre way of creating a family that to me, I guess, spoke to the extremity of the kind of imperative to biological or genetic families among some queer people. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on the article.
I mean, I'm in two minds. In a way, I think that that kind of family creation is quite a powerful response to navigating a system that's fairly constrained, both financially, because in the article they talk about being, you know, not having disposable income to pursue anonymous donors and surrogates, but also maybe not wanting to create that totally sort of formalized or industry-based or anonymized family where, you know, you use a surrogate that you never meet again, eggs surely. That you don't.
Yeah, donor as an item in a catalogue.
Exactly. Yeah, but I think that the lengths that people go to are also definitely representative of this sort of, this intensifying push to have genetic family. And so I'm not sure about the extent to which that can be queered, but I think it's an open question. Which relates not so much in the US, but in Australia, also to the really, really limited options for adoption. Another thought that springs to mind is just like an interest in opening as a thought experiment what it might be to think about those kinds of collaborative reproductive arrangements as monstrous in a queer way. You know, like they make us feel yuck because they're a bit abject or they're a bit monstrous or they're a bit strange. It's because, you know, this person's 60-year-old mother gives birth to the child.
Yeah, it's super, it's very unusual, right. You know.
But why does that make us uncomfortable?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like
yeah.
Why
Good
does
question.
A 60-year-old woman birthing a child make us uncomfortable? Maybe that's also an interesting queer route to think down because she's an inappropriate maternal body. Like,
fantastic.
Hmm.
How did you get interested in all of this?
It's a good question. I mean, apart from the personal investment in that, it's probably something that I have to think about one day because I might want to have a kid, and I'm queer. I think that this spike in family making raises really interesting questions for race and racial relatedness that are much broader than just queer family making. So I come from a mixed race family. My parents are heterosexual. But some of the questions about what it means to form a racial identity when you don't share the same identity as either of your parents and what it means to navigate difference and kind of bring together racial identities that feel in between with my queer identity that feels in between a lot of the time. I saw really kind of interesting and diagonal resonances with the kids growing up in queer families, many of which are multiracial. Yeah, so that sort of took me into the project.
The way you were describing having to build narratives of race that are perhaps separate from your parents' experience, that already feels super queer, right? Like,
exactly.
You know, most queer kids are not born into queer families.
Exactly. And that I think is another kind of avenue or resource that queers are really adept with, that we could use to think about these kinds of racial affiliations as well, like different kinds of horizontal identities, which kids growing up in queer, white, queer parented homes that maybe are half Indian, as many of my participants' kids were, both of them have navigated horizontal identities in their lives, and thinking about what queer identity creation looks like for kids and young people that are growing up queer might help us think about what it looks like to grow up racially different in a queer family.
I think I can go into conversations around this topic very cynically, and I try hard not to do that, but
yeah.
I feel like you're really selling me on a much more hopeful vision of this kind of family creation that is can use queerness as a point of empathy to think about other kinds of identity as well.
Right.
Is that something that you kind of got from these experiences, or am I totally just reading too much into this?
That's part of it. And also, like, I'm really interested in trying to think in an engaged and empathetic and open way about what it looks like to take reproduction seriously as a queer topic for making different worlds as well. I think that we have quite a long, powerful history of queer movements critiquing family creation and having children and parenting. But I think there are other possibilities and other genealogies, particularly from queer women of colour and queer feminists of colour, that talk about mothering as a really powerful way to make the future different, or to queer the future, or to create different networks of care. If we don't dismiss biological reproduction straight out as a heterosexual thing, you know, it doesn't have to be.
Jack Kinney, thank you so, so much. That was really wonderful.
You're very welcome.
Ben here again. I hope you enjoyed the interview. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with the second part of Simon and my two-part discussion, thinking critically about sex in queer politics. But in the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch, you can do so via email at queerspodcast@gmail.com, or we're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at queerspodcast. I'm on Twitter at Ben C. Riley, and Simon is at Simon Copland on Twitter and at Simon Copland Writer on Facebook. You can find episodes of the podcast on our website, queerspodcast.com, or subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or pretty much any other podcast platform. If you want to support the show, we also have a Patreon. Throw a few dollars our way at patreon.com/queerspodcast. We'd very much appreciate it. We've also started publishing short pieces of writing on the page exclusively for subscribers. So if you signed up there, you'll get access to those as well. Shout out, as always, to our podcast network, Lip Media. We'd also love it if you checked out some of their other shows, all of which are LGBTIQ focused. And finally, if you're enjoying Queers, tell a friend. Word of mouth is the best way we have to find new listeners. Thanks, as always, for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.